Well, the Q&A, our aim is to be done no later than 12. We'll do Q&A, we'll sing, we'll pray, and we'll leave. So that's kind of how the rest of the day is going to go. But do feel free to hang out and chat afterward. I got a good collection here of questions. We'll go through them. The majority of them are for Rich. I'll jump in if he gets a tough one and can't answer it.
Thank you.
And then at the end, if we still have time, we can take more questions from the floor. Okay, so as to masculinity, biblical masculinity, can you provide a reading list, 5 book recommendations for teaching, discipling masculinity?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I will say this, young men today are in a much better position in terms of available resources than say, I'm 51, than say when I was growing up in the 80s and into the 90s. The thing about the masculinity books in the 80s and 90s is that they tended to focus on generic Christian virtues with kind of a slight veneer of masculinity. Otherwise, the book could have been written for women just as easily. So they might say things like, well, to be a good Christian man, you need to love people and serve people and pray. All the things they focused on were all things that women should be doing too, that all Christians should do. So they didn't really get at what was specifically masculine. And in some ways, they were how oftentimes Christians will imitate what's happening in the wider culture. There was kind of this secular men's movement that was calling on men to be softer and more sensitive and that kind of thing. And Christians were doing their own version of that. So there were really not a lot of great Christian books written in that era. If you really wanted something, you had to go back and read older Christian authors, how they dealt with these questions, like during the Puritan era or Reformational era or something like that, what they said about manhood. But now in recent years, there's just been an explosion of really good work produced in this area. And so there are a lot of good things out there. So I'll just name some of the books that come to mind. I'm sure I'll miss some, and so Justin can supplement my list. But I would say Doug Wilson's book, Future Men, is very helpful for fathers raising sons and for boys themselves. It's really an overview of Proverbs and what Proverbs teaches about masculinity. Doug's book, Reforming Marriage, I read that right when it came out, right before I got married, and it really did help set a good foundation. It's a very helpful book. And then he's got another one that goes with that called Federal Husband. So all of those books are really good. Doug Wilson, his material on this is generally excellent. Michael Foster and Non Tenet did a book called It's Good to Be a Man, which has gotten a lot of attention in the last few years, and that's a very helpful book, so I'd recommend that one to you. There's a book by Zach Garris called Masculine Christianity, which it's really kind of a study of different biblical passages that address male-female issues, and he does a very good job with these things. And he's got a new one that just came out, which actually in my talk this morning I kind of alluded to, because he talks about some of the problems with Tim Keller and other contemporary teachers, that they might draw the line at the no women pastors, they might draw a line there, but they really don't have much substance to their teaching about roles within marriage or male-female roles within society, that kind of thing. They generally treat people in an egalitarian, androgynous kind of way. And his new book is called Honor Thy Father, so it's kind of a historical study of what the reformers said about manhood and womanhood. All that's good. I think in my talk, I mentioned William Mauser's work, The 5 Aspects of a Man, and then his wife Barbara Mauser, she did 5 Aspects of a Woman. That was really some of the best stuff that was available back when I was first really starting to learn about these things. Very influential on Doug Wilson and some others. So those would be books I'd mention. I'm sure you probably got a few others you can think of.
As a church, we went through J.C. Ryle's Thoughts for Young Men. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty small book, accessible, you can quick read. Right before marriage, I read John Piper's 50 Questions on Biblical Manhood. And I remember that being very influential about just taking responsibility in marriage, leading, not waiting, being a biblically faithful husband. A couple fiction books that might be, especially for the boys, just images of masculinity. I remember reading Red Badge of Courage when I was a kid, and that being very influential on courage and going into battle. A couple younger books, Little Britches, about taking responsibility for the family, Where the Red Fern Grows, in a Dominion kind of sense. Billy goes and just starts doing things. He has a goal, he goes out and works for it. Lord of the Rings, the importance of friendship, relationships, and there's a lot more obviously that goes into that series. So those are a couple books that I would add to that, but I agree, I was going to say Future Man and Performing Marriage.
I thought of one other book I'll mention, and that is a book called Man Up, and it's by a Lutheran, and I cannot remember his name offhand, but that's actually a good book. And then Justin talked about how, because the church has not really done a lot of discipleship in this area for men, a lot of young men have started to look outside of the church, and that has been a real issue. So, you know, maybe 10 years ago it was Rollo Tomassi, now it's Andrew Tate. And I would say these are dangerous sources to go get your understanding of masculinity. As Justin said, sometimes they say things that are true, maybe even insightful, but the whole framework is so messed up and depraved and anti-biblical, it's a huge problem. In fact, I would say insofar as they have bought into the sexual revolution or see it as irreversible, they're really actually still feminists. So even though they're peddling material for young men, and a lot of men are going for it, it's really not very helpful. But there is one book that I think the author is a Christian, but he wrote it from he basically wrote it as a secular book, so it doesn't make appeals to God or to Scripture. It's really more just this is how things are based on observation, based on nature kind of book. I don't think he really talks about evolutionary psychology the way a lot of the so-called red pill authors do and that kind of thing. But there's a book, I think his name is Greg Kriebel, and it's called Eggs Are Expensive and Sperm Is Cheap. Okay, weird title, I know. But he unpacks the meaning of that and a lot of other things, and that's actually a pretty helpful book, I think, for young men, too, just in kind of getting the lay of the land and how things work, understanding God's, what I would call God's creational design. He doesn't call it that in the book, but that's really what he's getting at.
One more we both forgot. Solomon Says by Mark Horn, a great book for discipleship, training young men. It's just really, he just goes through the book of Proverbs and exhorts you to good. He wrote the book, it kind of modeled a little bit after Jordan Peterson, 12 Rules for Life, from a biblical perspective. So Solomon Says by Mark Horn. All right, Rich, can you recommend a list of feminine virtues for women? And what weekend next spring do you want to have the women's conference on biblical femininity?
Yeah, let's save that one for the conference. It's a great question.
Okay. Since you ducked that question, what are some practical ways moms especially, but also grandmothers, aunts, women in the church, can help cultivate and hone godly masculinity in the home and other places, especially boys who are homeschooled and spend the majority of their time being taught by women? How do women participate in the masculine discipleship?
Well, there's a lot of things I could say there. For example, Paul tells Timothy that he learned the scriptures from his mother and grandmother from his infancy. So Timothy's dad is not in the picture, apparently. Paul becomes a kind of surrogate father, you could say, a spiritual father to Timothy. But obviously, Timothy's mother and grandmother had a formative influence in his life in teaching him the scripture. So I'd say that's foundational, especially in a homeschool context, just that kind of teaching. But this is also something I would say, is that as a mother, with all of your maternal influence on your boys as they're growing up, one of the most important things you can do is let go. And that's something a lot of moms have a hard time doing. And that's what makes boys into mama's boys, is when mom refuses to let go. And of course, it's dad's job to step in and help mom let go. I was actually reprimanded on the drive home last night, and I accepted the reprimand that I used the story of Peter Rabbit, because he disobeyed his mom, and that's why they wrote the story about him. He took risks, okay? But Peter doesn't have a dad. His dad had an accident of some sort. And so Dad's not there. So there's no moderating influence on mom in his life. That does not justify his disobedience, but you can understand why, with all of his young mass, I guess, rabbits, do male rabbits have testosterone, I assume? With all of those male juices flowing in him, he's got to go out and do something that's kind of exciting and take a risk, and his mom does not want him to do so. Okay, one thing, so his mom is a safetyist, okay? She doesn't want any risk or anything like that. Okay, I would say one of the best things a mom can do is learn to let go and listen to your husband about that. You know, you kids need moms and dads for a reason, because, you know, dad might be okay with a lot more risk than mom is. But, you know, like Doug Wilson tells the story, he says, you know, if a boy wants to go climb a tree and his mom says, no, you can't climb that tree, you might break a leg. The boy would be better off if he fell, or you might break an arm. You know, the boy would be better off if he climbed the tree and fell and broke both arms than if he never got to climb the tree. Okay? Now, my son broke both of his arms twice growing up. Okay? So, I mean, that's, and I'm not saying that's good that he broke his arms, but it's just you have to be okay with it, with some level of just letting your son go. For a boy to grow into manhood, in some way, he does have to separate from his mom. And then he can reconnect with her, but there does have to be some kind of separation. And usually it's the fathers or the male mentors in the boy's life that help him do that. You know, when a boy is very young, obviously he's mostly with his mother, but there does come a point where there's kind of a shift, and now dad takes over and does a lot, has a lot more interaction with his son. And sometimes moms stand in the way of that process and interfere with it and keep it from happening. And that's counterproductive to growing boys into masculine men. So that's one thing I would say. There's a lot of other things can be said, certainly. But that's maybe the biggest thing that stands out to me is, if you're a mom, you just got to let go of something.
Yeah, and add to that, including the story of Benjamin Bunny. Benjamin Bunny was reprimanded by his father for disobeying. So there. Fathers still participate in that disciplinary process. All right, education, Rich, education of boys. What routines, practices, procedures can you recommend to make a traditional classroom a place that fosters biblical masculinity in boys?
Well, we need to bring back dodgeball. And then, as you so eloquently put it, we need to bring back Smear the Queer. I'll take it too.
Smear the Queer.
I would say ideally education should be sex segregated. That doesn't mean, obviously you can still find ways to get boys and girls together and around each other, but I actually think the sexes learn much better if you can do education in a sex segregated way. Now hardly anybody's doing that well today, and certainly in the Christian, like say in the classical Christian education space, that's really not the way things are done, but I think it's something that when the finances and resources are there, that's, you know, in the next Christendom, that's the kind of thing we need to move towards, so maybe we can do that now, but as a goal, sex-segregated education is the way to go. And I would say, you know, like the ideal boys' school day is, you know, you show up for class in the morning, and you go to a math class, and maybe an English class, and then you go to a boxing class. And you go pound each other's brains out for 40 minutes, and then you go to history class, okay? And you have another few classes. And boys just have that energy, and they need those breaks. And they need the educational curriculum for a boy should include some kind of physicality. Again, I've made several references to Doug Wilson, and I so appreciate so many things he says in this area. You know, Doug said that seminaries should have football teams. Seminaries should have rugby teams. You know, something where there's a physical aspect to the education as well, because otherwise men can be emasculated. That academia does tend to be a feminizing environment, at least the way it's set up today. And so there are ways in which we have to push back against that. And you certainly want your boys to learn to sit still, listen, submit themselves to a teacher, absorb the material, take a test, and do well. You want all of that. Okay, but you also, so there is an element of learning how to do that and the discipline that comes with that. We want our boys to be able to sit through a service, a church service, and participate in it, and all the, you know, all those are great things that we're trying to do. But you also want to honor the nature of the boy, which means giving space to physicality. A lot of schools now don't even have a recess time. You know, so the kids are literally locked up in a classroom all day long. And it's no wonder the boys are very fidgety and don't fit in well in that environment. It's just not suited to who they are. So an education that goes with the grain of the child. You're still going to have to discipline and train and do all those things. I mean, I'm not talking about taking away from them. You need that kind of learning. But just honoring the nature of the child, honoring the nature of the boy. Anytime you're raising a boy, whether you're doing it as a mom and a dad or as a teacher in a classroom environment, the hardest thing to do is to separate out the boy part from the sin part. Because sometimes the boy part, what an unfallen boy would look like, can still kind of look like sin to us, okay? Because just of that boyish nature coming through. And as Justin talked about, what you want to do is take that young masculine energy and really start to channel it towards things that are productive. You know, so I talked about sports. I didn't really do justice to manual labor, but teaching your boys to work with their hands. Here's another thing. The ideal boys' school day, yeah, you have a few classes. You do a boxing class or a martial arts class. You do a few more classes. You do shop class. And you're teaching the boys how to work with their hands and submit to objective reality outside of themselves and actually learn skills. I would say that's part of it, too. So I think an education for a boy, that's what it ought to look like. Very hard to find that today. Very hard to provide that for your sons today in the world we live in, because we don't have a whole community or culture that's bought into it. Very hard to make that happen. But those are the kind of things we need to be working towards in my view. And you may have some things to say about that too.
Yeah, that's good. I agree. Last year and 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to disciple a couple of young men. James, Robert James's, was one of them. And it was a CC, Costume Conversations class. And it was two guys. So we just thought, let's do this in a masculine way. So we did the respective subjects throughout the day, and then we did take a break, and we did some exercise, and got outside, and got sweaty. We would, you know, let's take a break, go outside, walk around for a little while, stretch your legs, move. Before being a pastor, I was a teacher in the government school, and I was in an area that had a lot of immigrants, refugees from difficult places, and we got a lot of kids from the Ivory Coast, Nigeria, Liberia, which had a lot of violence, and there were kids who had spent some time in a refugee camp. And in the refugee camp, there's no structure. So the kids just ran all around all day. Just no education, no structure. And then they moved to the United States, they moved to Minnesota, and they're in my classroom. And I had to teach them third grade. And they purposely loaded me with all these troublesome boys because I was the one male teacher in third grade. And during the subjects and the teaching lessons, I would be okay with boys just kind of fidgeting. I had boys in the classroom who were strategically placed there where they could stand up at their desk and work. And it was a struggle for me in that environment, because I had a classroom helper who was a mom, not a mom of these boys, but she would stand, she'd walk around the back and make sure back of the classroom, making sure everybody was paying attention, and she would constantly tell these boys to sit down. You know, everybody here sits, you need to sit. And all they're doing is standing. You know, they got energy, they want to move, and if they're doing their work standing, I was okay with that. So it did create some conflict in that, but there's the tension with a masculine teacher and a feminine teacher and understanding the needs of boys to get up and move around. So
I want to say one more thing about that too. I mean, you talking about teaching in that environment helped me think about something else. Obviously we want to push our boys towards excellence. We want to demand that they work hard. We want to teach them diligence. You can't become a godly man, a masculine man, without working hard. So we want to push that. At the same time, what I found with boys is that a lot of times school is a struggle until they find something they're interested in, and then they take off. Boys have this rage to master. So when they get interested in something, they just want to master it. They want to know everything there is to know about it. Okay, like if I were to tell you, and I didn't tell you if it's a boy or a girl, but I said, you know, there's a kid that has memorized all the statistics from this baseball team, you know right away I'm talking about a boy. Girls would never do that. they just know. But if a boy gets interested in baseball, I mean, he's going to know everything about his favorite baseball team, every player they've ever had, what the batting average was, everything. I mean, baseball, of course, endless number of statistics. I know boys that could rattle them off like they're an encyclopedia, okay? Because they got interested, and then they had this rage to master. And so a lot of times when you're raising a boy, what you're trying to find is, what is he interested in? What can he be really good at? Okay? Because that's where he's really going to excel. And then you won't have to motivate him. He's going to do it himself. Okay? So that's another thing, especially as your boy gets closer to time to figure out what the vocation is, figure out what he's really interested in. And then a lot of times, especially if the boy has been taught a work ethic just in a generalized kind of way, he's going to have such a desire to, you know, such a passion for what he's interested in that it's just going to take care of itself. And that's why there are a lot of boys who were C students who went on to do absolutely amazing, incredible things, because they were bored to death in the classroom. But as soon as they found what they were interested in, you didn't need a teacher, you know, saying, do the work. They just ran with it. And that's a really important thing, I think, to understand about boys as well. Girls are much more compliant, so they want to get the A and please the teacher, whether they're interested in it or not. So they'll just memorize a bunch of information to do well on the test. For boys, it's not going to be that way. Okay? They're not going to have that same just innate desire for compliance and to please other people. Boys don't mind being disagreeable. But if you can find what they're interested in, a lot of times that just takes over. And that's why, again, you got the boys who didn't do so well in school, but then who go on to be the CEO of the company or the great inventor or what have you, because they found something to hook their interest.
That's good. All right. Can you elaborate on video games? They're okay. Which ones are okay? What value do they offer, if any? What warnings would you give on video games?
Well, since my kids are older now, I'm a little bit out of the loop on video games and what's out there, so I would not be the best person to ask that question to. We did let our son play a very limited amount of time with video games when he was growing up, and made sure, you know, that there was nothing in the video game that was, you know, I mean, I think some video games now have very graphic sexual content and that kind of thing. Obviously, you don't want that. But we didn't let him play, but then, you know, when he went to college, he didn't take his Xbox with him. He had no desire to do that. I'm not saying he never played another video game, but it just wasn't something that was a huge part of his life. Things to know that can be very addictive: video games like social media are designed to use your own psychology against you and to get you addicted. So when you think of a video game, I mean, I'm not saying you have to think of it like heroin, but you're kind of exposing your kid to something that could be very addictive to them. And so be aware of that. So putting tight limits on that is important. Obviously, you know, people who want to be, who are very pro video game will say, oh yeah, well, it develops eye-hand coordination, and you know, it's a way that boys can bond with other boys. I'm not saying you can't find various forms of value in video games as an entertainment. But generally speaking, I think they take way too much time. They are addictive. You know, I talked about this fake war, it's fake dominion. You know, like you get the dopamine rush of having accomplished something without really accomplishing anything, okay? Social media kind of does something similar, and I think that's a problem. We want our sense of satisfaction from a job well done to stem from things mainly that we do in the real world that actually count and add value, you know, and bring truth, beauty, and goodness into the world, not just things that happen on a screen and then are gone. So I wouldn't say absolutely no, shut the door on that totally. I would just say be super, super careful with it. Keep it very confined, constrained. Understand what the dangers are, and you may have more to say about that than I do.
Yeah, I agree with all that, and that's guided our thinking on our kids with video games. One thing I would add is the opportunity cost of playing video games. What are we doing? What are we missing out on while we're playing video games? What could we be doing? So you're playing video games by yourself when you could be spending time with a person, a human being, enjoying a relationship with one another. You know, the social media dynamic with we're online together playing. So I'm here and you're there and we're playing together, we're fighting. Well, let's just get together and go out in the yard and fight. So what are we doing instead? But I agree with all that, and those warnings are good. Okay, so men reproving men. How would you encourage a man, a family member, who wants to be a stay-at-home dad? What counsel would you give someone to address that in a relationship?
I can't actually say what I would say in a mixed audience. So I'll just put it another way. I would say that you are totally emasculating yourself and denying your own male nature by giving up that burden of performance, that burden of provision, that burden of responsibility for your home, and presumably handing that over to your wife. I would say, in the long run, your wife is not going to respect you for this. In fact, it's very interesting, and the dad is out there on this. If you're really interested in this kind of question, I would say Suzanne Venter. She's kind of like a lapsed Catholic, but very conservative, and she writes mainly for women, but she touches on issues like this, and she's got all the data. You can find other places too. But in those marriages where the woman earns more than the man, or where she becomes the breadwinner, there's an extremely high rate of divorce. There's an extremely high rate of loss of attraction. So it kills the sexual relationship in marriage. It's role reversal, it's gender bending, it's gender twisting. So it creates all kinds of dysfunctionality in the marriage when the wife becomes the main breadwinner and he's the stay-at-home dad. It's not, you know, it's basically that whole egalitarian view that we're just interchangeable pieces here. So why not switch it up? Well, it's because God designed us for certain things. A masculine man would never be satisfied with that. Okay? And a feminine woman would never be satisfied with it either. She wouldn't want it. Okay? The workplace, there are jobs that women can work that do not masculinize them, but especially your higher earning, more stressful kinds of jobs really will harden and masculinize a woman. And she will lose a lot of that nurturing instinct, and she'll kind of get in a masculine frame of mind. She'll have a really hard time setting aside when she comes home. I mean, as a woman who's out there working all day while her husband is at home, is she going to really want to come home and then submit to her husband's leadership and follow his lead at the end of the day? No. So all those things Scripture commands about a husband's provision and leadership and a wife's, all that's just out the window at that point. And so it's not a surprise then you end up with really high rates of divorce in those kinds of marriages. And don't tell me, well, I know such and such and they made it work. Anecdotes are not data. Okay, the data is in line with what God says. I've said many times before that really sociology, good sociology, there's a lot of bad sociology, but good sociology exists just to show us that God's ways really are right. I mean, we should know that anyway, but the sociology just gives us the data to show us this is really the case. So I would just say you're asking for trouble and that's going to be a marriage that is very miserable and probably won't last.
Thanks for cleaning that up for us. Let me come at a similar argument from a different angle, just for wise application sake. I shared this video with my congregation about this young, no longer young, but this woman who pursued the career, accomplished all these professional goals, but she was past childbearing age, and she had regret. I've done all these things, and I'm ultimately unfulfilled, and I can't go back to my more fruitful years and do it again. So from a Christian standpoint, living in God's world, being a woman created for a purpose, looking from the outside in, what would we say to that situation? She's bought a lie, and she can't go back and do it again. And that lie did not help her, didn't bless her. If we could go back to that young lady 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and say, hey, this is how you're going to feel in the end. You still want to do this? So provide counsel to her in that situation. So we can see that from the outside in. Okay, we have the blessed privilege right now as we enter into this choice to be a stay-at-home father with the same end. It's not going to go well with you. This is not what you're created to be. You'll be unfulfilled. It will cause problems in marriage, in family. Um, you're, You have the blessed privilege right now to know all this before you make the choice. Don't make the same mistake so many people make with the gender bending and switching of roles, and they ultimately end up with regret. So let's be wise about this right now.
Yeah, so just one other thing about that. I mean, obviously there are some women who would have loved to have been married and it doesn't happen for them, and we can lament that with them. I mean, we can say they experienced their singleness as a trial. Okay, they didn't have the gift of singleness for them. It's a trial. It's just like if somebody got married and say their spouse died early on and they didn't have the opportunity to remarry. You might say, well, you experienced your singleness really as a trial. Okay, so we need to recognize that can happen. But you know, J.D. Vance talked about the childless cat ladies. Okay, and he's gotten in trouble for that comment that he made a while back. But that's a real phenomenon. And what has happened is feminism has lied to women and said that what really matters is family, is career. Career is more important than family. Pursuing your career is more important than having children. So put off having children. Apparently these people don't know about the fact that a woman's fertility is limited to a certain period in her life. I don't know, they must have skipped that day of biology class or something. But they just think, oh, I can just defer this and kick this can down the road and I can just have kids later. I'm going to pursue my career right now. Lots of women buy into that. And they find out too late that denial of their nature, that denial of their own identity, that denial of their calling, that denial of God's command to them, it finally catches up with them and they really are miserable. And what we are headed for now, that we have so many women who have rejected marriage, rejected having children, thinking that career would make them happy, and then doing this for many years and finding out that actually that really doesn't satisfy, we are headed for a situation where we have more women like that than we've ever had, and they will be politically active, and they will look for the state as much as possible to provide for them what they missed out by having a family. So there's no family to take care of them as they get old. They want Uncle Sam to do it, to be a surrogate husband and father to them, and even kind of a surrogate child in a way, taking care of them. And of course, that will come at the expense of the U.S. taxpayer. That's what we're headed for. So when I make comments like, you know, our civilization depends upon us getting this right, I really do mean that. I mean, this is the existential crisis, is figuring out how to get men and women to be manly and womanly again, and pair up, get married, form a family, and raise children together. Everything depends on that. And you can say, oh, we can just evangelize people, we'll grow the church that way. Not if there's no people to evangelize, because people aren't having babies. There's no getting around the fact that the creation mandate stands behind and is foundational to the Great Commission. If people are not being fruitful and multiplying, we got really, really big problems. It's a sign of a very sick society. So yeah, this stuff really does matter.
And from a political standpoint, Vance really stepped in it because Trump was counting on the childless cat lady vote. I mean, that voting block is really important.
It is the most radicalized voting block out there. That's scary for sure.
Okay, so why is masculinity in culture? Daniel Perry courageously intervened in a New York subway, is now on trial for his life. This is in New York City, intervened to a crazy man in the subway, subdued him, the man died, now he's in jail on trial. So how should men view prudence in a culture that punishes masculinity with courage to one's own hurt?
Yeah, the Daniel Perry story is very interesting. So he intervened to stop a crazy man on a subway or something.
Threatening women and children.
Threatening women. So he did the manly thing, the right thing to do. He stepped in, took charge of the situation to protect others, okay, to neutralize the threat, as we say. And he's being punished for that, okay? I saw not too long after that, there was this trend of men going up and randomly punching women in the face in New York. Something like that was happening. And one of these probably, you know, childless cat ladies that's in politics said something like, well, where are the men who are to stand up for this? And it's like the answer was, well, I mean, the men who were standing up to this kind of thing, you're about to throw them in prison. Okay, that's why men are not doing anything. So, yes, I do think you need to be prudent. So you kind of have to balance your male honor, doing the right thing, protecting women and children. You got to balance that with the reality of the situation that you might be punished for doing so. And I would say you have to have a lot of situational awareness and then just make what you think is the wisest, most prudent pathway forward. That might include leaving places like New York City and going to some place that's not going to punish you for defending yourself or defending other people the way they do there. I mean, it's a suicidal thing what they're doing if you tell people they really can't stand up for themselves or stand up for other people. Okay, so there's not an obvious, easy solution to that problem. Balance your manly honor against those other considerations. Do what you believe is the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think the complaint on social media is the embodiment of that Lewis quote, which escapes me now. The bid the gelding fruitful, men without chests. Masculinity has been chased out of the public square, and we're lamenting its absence. This may be a troll. Should we repeal the 19th Amendment?
What kind of country do you want? The 19th Amendment is very interesting. So this is the amendment where women were granted the right to vote. I'll say several things about this. One is, I don't think this is something that Scripture speaks to directly. There's a lot in the Bible about choosing your leaders. We're not told procedures or anything like that in any kind of great detail. So you could say that this is something that falls into adiaphora, and leave it at that. But I would say in our nation, so the way things happen in America, there are several interesting things to note about the 19th Amendment. One is, when the 19th Amendment was passed, it was passed by men, because obviously only men had the right to vote at that time. But it may have been one of those cases where men wanted to please women and give women what they thought they wanted, as opposed to doing what might have been best for the family or for the country. But actually, it's even worse than that. Most women in 1920 didn't even want the right to vote. It was actually a small sort of fringe group of women who basically had probably been mistreated by fathers or husbands or something like that, who had an axe to grind with men and said, we can't trust men to look out for us, and so we need the right to vote. And men ratified the 19th Amendment and gave women the right to vote. It's important to understand, too, prior to the 19th Amendment, the understanding was not that men vote and women don't, okay? The real way it was understood is households vote, and they do so through their heads, okay? With the 19th Amendment, we went from a household-based society to what you might call an identity-based society. You could say an individualistic society, but really, the passage of the 19th Amendment is really the beginning of identity politics in American history. Because now women coalesce as an interest group, okay? It's no longer the head of the household is going to vote for what is best for his household. It's that we're all individuals, we all have our own interests, and my interests may or may not align with members of my own family. They may be more likely to align with this other group I'm a part of, this other demographic I'm a part of, and so women become a block, as it were. That's the beginning of identity politics. Now, we are still dealing with identity politics in our day. In fact, after that, the whole history of American politics is the history of identity politics. Okay, I used to ask my kids, you know, this is kind of a dinner table discussion question I would ask my kids. I would say, look, is there a law that they could pass down in Montgomery or up in Washington, D.C.? Is there a law they could pass that would be good for me and bad for your mom or vice versa? And my kids would think about that and say, no, not really, because y'all are one, and if it hurts one of you, it's going to hurt both of you, or if it helps one of you, it's going to help both of you because you're one, and you know, it's really what's best for the household. I mean, that's how you think. Like, exactly. And that's what we sacrificed on the altar of the feminist movement when we adopted the 19th Amendment. We went from a nation of households to a nation of interest groups is really what happened. And it's very important to understand that about American history. So whatever you might think about women voting versus head of households voting and that kind of thing, it's important to understand in the history of our own nation, this is what has happened. And what you can see then is that there are all kinds of appeals made to women as voters, as if women had interests that are contrary to those of their husband or children even. Women have become this identity group that we've got to do special things to appeal to the women vote. Okay? I mean, I would say, even if you have women voting, ultimately a woman should be in submission to her husband. And unless it would be a sin to vote a certain way, she ought to vote in accordance with her husband's desires. So having women vote would be a way of doubling up his vote. Okay, but that obviously hasn't happened. And again, you can look at the data, and women, I think because they're more swayed by emotion and by other things, because they're empathetic, and while empathy has its place in the domestic sphere, out in the public world, empathy is a disaster, okay? But women have voted for radically left-wing candidates and policies increasingly. So married women, not quite so much, again, because they're tethered to a husband, and so that helps. But you can go back and look at the data. The more conservative candidate would have won every single election since the 19th Amendment was ratified if women did not vote. But if women only voted, of course, the more liberal or progressive candidate would have won at pretty much every single election, just about every single election. Okay? And certainly that's the case now. Okay? Women voters, and especially single women, are the most radicalized voting bloc we have. And so, yes, that's why you get questions about the 19th Amendment, because it has radically changed the character of our country. Did it have to be that way? No, not necessarily. You could have a context in which women vote in a more conservative way. I think that would be possible. But that's not the way it's worked out in our history, and we need to carefully consider that. There are women out there, I think Ann Poulter said this one time, I've heard a few other women say this, you know, more conservative women who would say, I would gladly give up my right to vote if other women had to also, because I think it would be the best for the country. I know what it would do to the electorate, the kinds of candidates we get, and the policies we get, and that would be good for the country. And I appreciate that there are some women out there who are willing to say that.
That's good.
That's not a troll question. It's no realistic possibility. So in that sense, it's totally hypothetical. It's not something that can happen anytime soon. But it's still something for us as Christians to think about it. I think it's a good thought experiment.
That's good. Thank you. Thank Rich for coming again for the conference.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's take our songbooks and let's sing one more song. Let's open a Mighty Lord, Extend Your Kingdom. And that's